Hello, everybody. I'm Dwayne Mancini, and welcome to another episode of the Project MedTech Podcast. If you have anything from us or would like to suggest a future guest, you can email us at info@projectmedtech.com. If you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. For more information on Project MedTech, our events we host, our consulting and advisory services, and to sign up for our monthly newsletter, visit our website, www.projectmedtech.com, and follow us on LinkedIn. If you're enjoying this content, don't forget to check out our other podcasts by searching Funding MedTech on your favorite podcast platform or by heading to our website. Funding MedTech is our newest podcast that is a spinoff of our MedTech Money podcast series. There won't be any new episodes of MedTech Money, but I encourage you to check out those old episodes as there is some awesome content on raising and investing capital. Funding MedTech is an interview style podcast focused on exploring ways to fund MedTech innovation and will be released weekly on Wednesdays. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by the law firm of McDonald Hopkins. Building medtech companies the right way based on great technology is not a one-size-fits-all endeavor. McDonald Hopkins provides customized and proactive strategies that align clients' valuable medtech technology with their business goals. This, in turn, builds those clients into successful, thriving companies. With strong experience and depth in the startup, venture capital, intellectual property, and fundraising arenas, McDonald Hopkins can be an important part of your team to help you develop the medtech business that you envision. In this episode, Randy Armstrong at Valentium and I discuss innovations, breakthroughs, and challenges in IPG development, and so much more. So without further ado, my discussion with Randy Armstrong.
Medical innovation starts with medical discussion. Talking about the future, what comes next with Project MedTech.
Welcome to the podcast, sir.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yep. So, Randy, introduction into who you are, your background in the medical device space, and what you currently do.
Okay. I am the Chief Technology Officer at Valentium. We produce medical devices. We design them, we manufacture them, and we do it for many, many clients, many, many different types of devices. And my background is in medical device design, more specifically active implantables, and even more specifically neuromodulation or nerve pulse generators. My background has been in cardiac space, in neuromodulation space, and it's been through all phases of design development. I'm old enough to have seen design controls come, grow, get established, and I'm now enjoying seeing how all of those design controls are producing much more safe, much more efficacious devices, and we're able to treat so many more things.
Yeah, very cool. I talked to Dan, the CEO of Valentium, one of the co-founders, yesterday on a podcast. Now that one won't be released until later on, but the recording was yesterday. Boy, he's an infectious person to be around.
yes, he is.
Yeah, he talked about the culture and the mission, the vision, and I was going to ask you, why did you join Valentium? But I'm guessing culture played a pretty big role in that.
Exactly. Dan and his co-founder, Tim Carroll, just had a beautiful vision, knowing that they wanted to impact people's lives through improved technologies, improved devices, and they were looking for talented people. But most importantly, they said, this is a company that's going to be built around values of character, which will yield great things for the world. And yes, infectious is the right word, and extremely motivating. And as a result, it's been one of the best work environments I've ever been in. Very collaborative, very encouraging, and very productive.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's something that, I had an interview with David Duram from Greenlight Guru, and he spent a lot of time on culture in the conversation as well. And then, so the guy over my shoulder here is one of my co-founders, Aaron Tenues, and he's our COO. We kind of sat down and said, hey, we're going to start growing. We need to figure out culture ASAP. So we went to a baseball game and talked about it for the entire duration of the game, which was like, you know, 3 hours. I don't think we watched a single pitch, right? Because they were so in depth on the vision, the mission, the culture, the just kind of covering all of it. And so anyways, I was just, when I talked to Dan yesterday, it like totally made sense on why people want to work at Valentium. So when did you join Valentium?
In 2014. So okay. Coming up on 10 years ago.
Wow. So 2 year, I mean, it was founded in 2012, right? So,
yes.
So you joined, okay. So you've been there for quite a few years.
I was employee number 7.
Oh, very cool. Awesome. Okay. So we're talking today about innovations, breakthroughs, and challenges in IPG development. And I asked you before the call, but I love acronyms and I also hate acronyms because, like for an example, I come from the CRO world, which mm-hmm. stands for, in my CRO world, stands for Contract Research Organization. And in most people, it stands for Clinical Research Organization, right? So it really just depends on where you come from. So what does IPG stand for?
Implantable Pulse Generator. Okay. It's a subset of active implantable medical devices, which are medical devices that have a power source. There are some implantable devices that just monitor and send data out, but implantable pulse generator is one that actually provides a stimulus for some effect.
Understood. So this is mostly used in neuro, or?
Yes, it's very common. The two big thrusts in neuro, right now you've probably seen a lot of press about brain-computer interfaces, and many of those are monitoring devices. So those would be active implantables, the larger subset, but not a pulse generator. Now, there are devices for neuro that are to provide a therapeutic effect, to reduce pain, to reduce seizures, to reduce depression, and those will provide a stimulus, so they will be producing pulses.
Right. Very cool. And then are there other areas where this is being used? Like, I guess let's start with the innovations and breakthrough spaces. I guess, you know, maybe educate the listeners who are tuning in on, I guess, maybe even taking it back so we can understand the history of it. Is like, when was it first used, and where has it been going the last so many years?
Right. The idea of stimulating nerves to produce an effect goes way back. Some of the first electrically excitable cell studies done, and I forget the exact date, but hundreds of years ago, were to produce muscle or nerve reactions. And so there's been a long-term recognition, but the idea of putting an implantable device in to deliver a stimulus to a nerve for some efficacy, a lot of that was driven in the research from the 1960s, 70s, and in the 1980s was the real growth of devices, particularly for addressing pain. But then by the late 80s, early 90s, there was a realization that the nervous system provides a whole lot more control in the feedback loops of the human body. And people began to realize that stimulating certain nerves in certain ways can produce unexpected effects, but desired effects. A classic example was Jake Zabara in the 1980s had recognized that stimulating the vagus nerve could reduce seizures in animals and felt that that could be applied to humans. And that was the birth of vagus nerve stimulation for the treatment of epilepsy. And that was one of the first implantable devices that treated, I'd say, a non-pain indication. And then very quickly they saw other side effects that, hey, it reduced depression, or it helped reduce appetite or control appetite. So there was a recognition that these nerve pathways, if stimulated appropriately, could treat a lot of conditions. And so I'd say the late 90s, early 2000s was a little bit of a wild west of exploration. What could these things do? So a great explosion of potential applications. Of course, these things take a great amount of time to be clinically demonstrated, to be shown to be efficacious. So it has not been like with pacemakers, you don't get an instant response, but there has been enough promise and enough things shown that there is an extremely wide variety of aspects and applications for neuromodulation.
Yeah, so can you also use these to shut down nerves as well?
Yes. So there's inhibition, where the stimulation is intended to reduce something. There is activation. You're trying to activate something. There's sometimes where they call it neuromodulation, because what you're doing is just attempting to change a feedback loop, perhaps. So in some cases, there are certain studies that say that there's too much signal. And then in this case, the neuromodulation would try to reduce some signal, or there's not enough, and it would add to the signal.
Yeah, and I guess so we're kind of covering the innovations. Let's stay on the innovations and breakthrough space here, and then I want to get to the challenges.
Okay.
More specifically, like design, FDA concerns, clinical concerns, concerns for patients, right? I'm sure there's a whole list there. But on the innovation breakthrough side, so where are we at? Are we kind of at that tipping point where we feel as if we understand this? There's a lot of people kind of playing in this space, right? Like, it usually takes time. Anytime you look at innovation, right, it takes a little bit of time, and then all of a sudden it creeps up, and it just goes from there. I guess, where are we at on that innovation bell curve?
We are past the exuberant excitement stage, where we are now being more constrained in what we go forward with. There was, again, in the late 90s, early 2000s, there was such an excitement about the possibility that a whole lot of projects were started without a real good understanding of the mechanisms of action. What are we trying to attack? And is there an appropriate neuromodulation that doesn't have inappropriate side effects? So there were a lot of fits and starts. There were a lot of clinical trials that were not properly designed to tease out the safety, or more importantly, the efficacy. And so innovation slowed down a little bit in the, I'd say, the 2010 range, and it went back to a little bit more fundamentals of mechanism of action. And a lot of clinicians and neuroscientists went back and looked at what is the actual thing that we're trying to stimulate, the thing that we're trying to modulate, and what are markers to tell whether you're succeeding or not. And that helped reset the footing, so that product development, the actual implementation of a device, was a whole lot more focused, and the clinical question about how do you prove efficacy was better established. So now what we're having, the current thrust is a whole lot more, I would say, fewer products, but each one is better focused, and it's turning out to be more successful. More devices are getting approved for new indications.
So I guess, did we reached the point, because this is we see this a lot in medical technology, where you need to start with a problem first and then develop your solution around that. I guess I could see how in this scenario specifically, you would have this scenario where you went out to solve a specific problem with a implantable pulse generator.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden that starts to look like a real shiny new, it looks like, you know, all of a sudden it's like, well, we could use it in here, and now we can use it here, and we can use it here. And then it becomes like, well, but we don't have problems there. It's being solved fine. Right. Did we see a little bit of that with this too?
Yes. As a cautionary tale, a lot of people coming into neuromodulation are a neuroscientist, and they would love to have a device that is useful for their key indication, but it could also be used for X, Y, and Z as well. And if that feature set grows beyond, it becomes a distraction, because your core application, the thing that brought you to the table of wanting to make this device, is the most important idea. And don't let distractions take you away from that, because every little thing that you add, well, it does add a burden of proof, a burden of development, a burden of maintenance. Devices are extremely complex, and one of the most important lessons is to manage that complexity and make sure it doesn't become a beast of its own.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, we talked about the fun innovations and breakthroughs. What are some of these hurdles and challenges? Let's start with regulatory first before we even get into, or actually, you know what? It's up to you. You choose. Do we want to start with design issues, or do you want to start with regulatory issues?
Well, let me start with design, and then I'm going to work my way back to those fundamentals. I want to reiterate, the most dangerous and burdensome thing about medical device design is it requires an incredible amount of rigor. And that's not, it can go bureaucratic, and you want to avoid that. You want to do this rigor for its purpose, to make sure that your device is safe, to make sure that it meets the efficacy goals, because this is an important thing. It's mission critical. It is life and death in many cases. So because of that rigor, every detail must be done with discipline and must be done with thoughtfulness. So as you can see, the more thoughtfulness and rigor that's necessary, it's better to keep things simple. So you have fewer plates you have to keep spinning. You have fewer threads that get tugged on. So simplicity is one of the most important things. And when you lose sight of that, that's when things go south. You pretty soon find you're putting a whole lot of resources on aspects and tasks that are not value added. So what is value added? The most important thing to remember is it's about making a safe and effective design. So you're doing a neuromodulation device. Good thing is a lot of safety aspects are predefined by standards. Those standards are vetted by industry, by regulatory bodies. These standards give you a baseline that if you're going to make a neuromodulation device, these are aspects you can't skimp on and you must meet. Now, there will be some safety aspects that are unique to your device. If I'm making a device that stimulates the brain for a certain therapy, I need to make sure that my therapy is not harming the brain in other ways. And it's more than just physical or electrochemical harm. It may be data harm. Let's say I'm treating depression, but a bad side effect is I cause loss of memory. Well, that's a harm. That's where the clinical trial and your design and your mechanism of action needs to be planned out very well. So that's closely tied also to the efficacy side. The second most important part of your medical device besides safety is efficacy. So if you're doing an innovative device, you may have some innovative aspects that are producing efficacy, and then innovative aspects you're going to need to prove efficacy. Neuromodulation in particular is very difficult, particularly now it's being applied for psychiatric conditions. Very hard to prove the efficacy of that device in an economic way. So designing for efficacy and designing for a study of efficacy is a very, very difficult and tricky spot. Yeah.
So Randy, let's talk about that efficacy part, because I find this interesting. So my background's in medicinal chemistry, so it's actually on the drug side. And, you know, one, it's like I look at where you would be competing in terms of neuromodulation, and it's directly against pharma. And if you read some pharma studies, efficacy standards are much lower. You know, like what is considered effective there? It seems different. Like there's almost like this, sometimes with med tech, it's kind of like, especially when it comes to the neuro space, you don't have to, it's not like black and white. You just have to be better than what the pharma use is.
Yes.
Right? It's really interesting to me. So that's a space that's very gray when I think about med tech going against pharma.
Right, but there is a slightly higher bar that you get for an invasive medical device. Mm-hmm. It takes surgery to implant it, right. And therefore, you've got to show a much greater efficacy. And I can't quantify it here, but a much greater efficacy, because with many pharma, you can merely just stop the drug and no harm, no foul, hopefully. So there is a slightly higher bar.
That makes total sense. It's just like almost perspective on how you look at things, right? LSI in Dana Point in March, and they were talking, and I didn't really this about surgeries. It makes sense, right? But if you can use, there's minimally invasive surgery, which we obviously know is better than surgery, right? It reduces the complications by a certain percentage. But using a natural orifice is even better than minimally invasive. And they have this like loads of data that shows the improvements by percentages to show that. And so it makes total sense when, you know, it says for a drug, it's like people look at it and say, well, I have to take a pill every day, or I can have this one surgery done and implanted, but that one surgery is still mm-hmm. risky. Right. So that makes a lot of sense. Where are the other challenges lie? Or you have another?
Yeah, I want to tack on to that last one, because a lot of that debate, there are patients who will say, I'd rather have the implant because it's out of mind. Patient compliance with taking drugs is sometimes challenging. So if someone could say, hey, I have a condition and I can take a pill every day that reminds me I have that condition, that's depressing. If you could put an implant in me that lasts for 7 years and every day I'm not reminded that I have that condition, that's a plus. So, yeah, there's an interesting twist.
Yeah. No, totally. I think there's a lot to be said for patient compliance with medication. And understanding that the time of day you take it, whether you take it on an empty stomach or not, did you take it with water? Like, these are all things that affect the absorption. And I remember, you know, as a talk about usability, in our human factors testing in med tech, the human factors testing in pharma is when do you take certain things, and the environment in which they're taking it, and how does that affect absorption rates and metabolism, and all these other factors. And so it's a really interesting thing. I'm excited for the future of medtech and to have a front row seat, because this is really like the first time in my career, and now granted I'm really early on, where medtech has gone against pharma, really gone against pharma in my opinion. And there's a lot in this neuro space, mental health space, that I think, you know, having an education in pharma but being in medtech and running a company literally called Project MedTech, I'm not very biased either way, but I'm excited to watch this kind of play out here.
Yes, you were reminding me as we were talking about when people take things, about challenges. What are some of the challenges that we have to deal with? And when we talk about patient compliance, one of the fundamental things that an active implantable device has to deal with first and foremost is, where's it getting its energy? Because unlike pharma, an implantable device needs electrical power. And that decision about where that energy is, how it's going to get to the implantable device, is fundamental, because it affects, of course, the therapy, how long a device will last, how much interaction a patient needs. The dream is to make a device that is implantable, never needs a new power source, and just works for the life of the patient. Neuromodulation, by different indications, requires very vastly different amounts of energy. So one of the first things a design team has to do is establish what is the power profile that this therapy is going to need. And then, therefore, is it a rechargeable device? If it's rechargeable, who's going to recharge it, how often, and what now have you just put another burden back onto the patient and reminded them you have a device. So that's one of the biggest challenges, but it's probably the first and most fundamental challenge that needs to be addressed in IPG design.
Yeah, the power source one has to be a huge one. Has there been a lot of innovation there in recent years?
There has. I will say that the big breakthroughs were in the 1970s and probably maybe about a decade and a half ago with improvements in lithium batteries. That's great stuff. We're happy that the automotive industry is pushing lithium research much further, but still the fundamentals of how energy is stored hasn't greatly changed. There has not been that quantum leap that we need. When it happens, it will be great, but we're still all having to work with relatively mature energy storage devices.
Yeah, interesting. And these devices, I'm sure, have to be connected then as well, right? Connected to the cloud in some way.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Walk me through some of the challenges there. Because now, if I'm looking at this, right, there's the challenges of having the power supply, implanting the product, getting it in. But now it's kind of like, okay, now it's going to the cloud. There's data up there. Can it be controlled? There's cybersecurity issues. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's got to be a pretty big concern too with some of these products.
Yes, there's the fundamental infrastructure that needs to be addressed. As you mentioned, cybersecurity is essential. But there's also a shifting need in what the cloud is doing for the patient, therapeutic or in the therapy cycle. Previously, it was largely a clinician-centric, cloud-based. The clinician just wants to know, how's the device doing? How's the patient doing? Is everything working as expected? And that comes from the mature cardiac market. But now with neuro devices, it's more than that. There is a recognition that the information that a device could monitor on the nerves, from the nerves, particularly from the brain, this information could be used to make a better interpretation of the patient's state. Or in several of these brain-computer interface projects, it provides the real computing horsepower to translate those neural signals into, let's say, speech or into motion. So that high-end computing power, which generally can't fit into the implant, is now on the outside. It has to make some real-time decisions and turn that into something, again, whether it be speech or motion.
Yeah, awesome. Other challenges in the space?
My mind is spinning right there on the the cloud side, because the challenges there are creating an infrastructure that's going to be ready for the next generation of neuromodulation proposals, where people want a real-time therapy response, but it takes cloud-based, let's say potentially machine learning, using the phrase artificial intelligence. If those are needed, that becomes a much, much more complex task, mostly from the real-time requirements, what's necessary in that feedback loop. And then, of course, the regulatory requirements of how do you ensure safety and efficacy.
How scary is a closed-loop system that auto-regulates impulses, right? Because this is something that maybe back in 2016, when I was with another company, we worked with a group that essentially would take it wasn't in the insulin space, it was in a different space, but they would take blood levels of a specific drug, and if it got out of a range, instead of manually administering the drug, it would say, okay, well, it needs to increase the drug by this much to keep it within in a tight range. And the data behind that was, it completely blew humans out of the water when it came to, because we react to a specific symptom, and there's that timing of that. And so they were able to control these parameters, and the results were incredible. However, the FDA was so concerned with it being a closed loop system, right? And not having any control, human interjection, I guess. And so with neuromodulation or any of these IPG products, if you were to have something where it was monitoring, but also, providing that electrical source when something got out of whack, is that scary for folks?
Yes, I would say the technical aspects of it are not scary, because many of those are mature, well understood, and design controls will take care of the technical. A lot of it is the biophysical aspects that are a little bit scary if you're doing something unprecedented. So many things in the neuro world, a signal that we'll be looking for as an indication for a need for more or less therapy may just be a proxy for the real need. And so the question will be, is your proxy reliable enough? Does it give you false positives? Does it give you false negatives? So a lot of the scariness will be in the validation of that proxy. And if you validate it well, the scariness begins to go away.
Yeah, awesome. All right, Randy, looking out 5-10 years, where's this space going with implantable pulse generators?
The press and attention is very heavy on brain computer interfaces, and that is exciting work. But right below that, there are going to be a large number of devices that employ nearly that same complexity, but for much more targeted non-cognitive neuromodulation. There will be some indication where I don't want to say any particular organs or therapies, because we may be working with those in the very near future, but there will be companies that are attempting to treat a very common ailment, but using more sophisticated machine learning, very sophisticated detection, pattern detection, and then stimulus delivery to treat, where we're using not quite as flashy of stuff as brain-computer interfaces, but pretty darn close, and therefore more successfully treating things. That's where I think the next 5 years are going to be. Now, the difficulty with that is those take time in clinical trials to prove, so I don't think you're going to see them emerging in 5 years, probably in the 7-year range, but the development will be happening over the next 5 years.
Yeah, excellent. Those are the kind of areas I'm most generally like to follow, right? So episode 104 potentially was a guy by the name of Dave Albert. He was he's the chief medical officer, but he was the founder of AliveCor. They have the little EKG credit card. Essentially, it's like the size of a credit card. It goes in your wallet. You put your fingers on there, you get it. And he had mentioned, he gave a keynote at an event called 10X a couple years ago in San Diego. And he said, be an orthogonal thinker, right? And what his point there was, it's not to run against everybody, but if everyone's going this way, just kind of go that way, but at a 90-degree angle, right? And so that's where, when we talk about fields like this, it's like everyone's going to the neuro space and brain interface space, but there's always like the second and third thing that people don't want to pay attention to that eventually become behemoths as well. And so I'm always interested when I talk to people in the innovation space on what are those numbers 2, 3, and 4 areas, because oftentimes people aren't paying attention to them and there's a good opportunity there.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. All right, Randy. Well, listen, I appreciate you doing this. We'll have Valentium's website tagged in the show notes. We'll have your LinkedIn in the show notes. Hang on for a minute. We'll chat offline. But thanks again for sharing your knowledge in the IPG space.
Thank you. It's a privilege talking with you.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. If you need anything from the podcast, you can always contact us at info@projectmedtech.com. Thanks for listening and have a great day.